Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Welcome to episode 101. I'm happy to have Mia St. John. Mia St. John was born in San Francisco, California. Her fighting career started soon after at the age of six, completing in Taekwondo. Mia earned a black belt and received a bachelor's degree in psychology from California State University of Northridge in June of 94. In 1996, Mia decided to pursue her true passion full-time, the sport of combat. Valentine's Day 1997, Mia made her pro debut in boxing, knocking out her opponent in 54 seconds into the first round. Mia signed with Don King and stayed with him for a year and a half before she left King for his rival Bob Arum of Top Rank. At Top Rank, Mia spent 4 years opening for all of Oscar De La Hoya's major fights. Mia has fought all over the world, including Beijing, China, where she won her IBA championship. After accumulating an unheard-of boxing record of nearly 60 pro fights, on June 14, 2008, Mia fulfilled her dream of fighting in her mother's home country of Mexico. She fought one of the toughest fights of her career and became the WBC International Boxing Champion of the World at age of 40. In November of 2010, Representative Grace F. Napolitano joined Mia and LA Laker Ron Artest for an official mental health and suicide prevention training at Napolitano's district office in Santa Fe Springs. Artest and St. John have joined Napolitano to promote the Mental Health in Schools Act, legislation she authored, which would increase federal funding for mental health therapists in schools. She has also spoken at the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, where President Barack Obama made a riveting speech at the CHCI's annual gala. As well as Congress, Mia speaks in schools and juvenile halls on the importance of education and overcoming hardship. She speaks of her own battles with mental illness, addiction, poverty, and overcoming it all to become a three-time international boxing champion. On August 14, 2012, Mia fought Christy Martin in a long-awaited rematch. Her dream of 16 years finally materialized, and at the age of 45, she captured the WBC Super Welterweight Championship of the World. The focus of much of today's conversation is on Mia's new memoir, called Fighting for Her Life. I'm absolutely humbled and blessed and lucky to be able to have Mia on to talk about all of her grief and loss and the ways in which she's channeled this grief and loss into mental health advocacy and really important work in our world. Again, a huge thank you to Mia. Hello and welcome to episode 101 of the Chills of Will podcast. Such a pleasure today to be joined by Mia St. John. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. The book is over my, left shoulder. Incredible read. And, you know, we're going to get into the more serious things. And, you know, first of all, I just want to thank you so much for writing the book. It's, you know, not necessarily a fun read, but an important read and one that really helps, you know, so many of us who have grief in our lives. So thank you for writing it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm hoping to help other people that are going through or have gone through what I've gone through and hopefully shine some hope in their lives.
No doubt about it. I was just saying before recording that you have the coolest Zoom wallpaper I think I've ever seen. So I definitely got to step my game up.
It's of course my boxing photo.
Right. For those who have been living under a rock for the last 20 years, you know, you're a boxer. I got one boxing question before we get to the more serious things. Like, you know, you can train, obviously, like you can train your abs, you can train with the jump rope, you can train like that. How do you train to get hit in the face?
You don't at first, you know, like when I very first started many, mm-hmm. many moons ago, it's always a shock.
Okay.
It's always a shock. And especially when you get your bell rung, that's a shock too, but you get used to it, you know, okay. You get used to it and you suffer the concussions just like, you know, all us fighters do. And you just, yeah, you kind of learn to live with the headaches.
Okay. I appreciate that. I've always wondered that, you know, it's like, all right, you know, you do the sit-ups, you do the crunches. Okay, cool. You run, you, like you talk about in the book, you go up to Big Bear and you go to Tahoe and you know, you train that, but it's like, how do you train to get hit in the face? Okay.
You don't. you got to be like, I've always said, like a fighter, you got to be like one crazy ass person,
right?
To be willing to get hit in the face and hurt, you know, another person. Like you got to be a little bit off your rocker.
right
a lot off your rocker,
a lot off your rocker, not a little bit. Oh man. Well, so the book's been out in the world for like a month, is that right? Maybe a little bit less.
No, for a couple, no, about like a week or so.
Only a week. I'm sorry. Wow.
It just came out. It was just released over the holiday.
That's right
And yeah. And there's a great feature. If you don't want to read the entire book, but you want a short or a synopsis, there's a feature mm-hmm. in People Magazine yes. out now, and it'll give you the gist of the book.
That's right. And I think the People Magazine article would whet the appetite because, yeah, the whole book needs to be read for sure. And no, I'm sorry. I'll chalk it up to COVID. You know, time doesn't even matter anymore. Right. I don't know why I was thinking it was been a month, but yeah, it's just been a couple of weeks. How does it feel to have your name on a book cover? How does it feel to have your book out in the world?
Well, you know, it's my second book,
right?
But this one meant so much to me because it was my memoirs. And the first book was a workout book, a health book, health right. and fitness book. And I've always wanted to do my memoirs, but I just didn't get the opportunity or any offers, should I say, from any publishing companies until after my ex-husband passed. And then I got a call from my literary agent in New York, and he said, hey, we have an offer for you to write your memoirs. And I thought, okay, wow, not good timing, because my ex had just passed, but I thought it's a chance to get my story out there and what happened to my son and his father and myself.
Well, I mean, there's so much, it's such a profound book. There's so much loss. It's, you know, I'm just in awe of you to lay it out so much like that and so openly, and, you know, that it will help so many people. I wonder what some of the, I know it's early and it's only been a couple of weeks, but I wonder what some of the feedback you got, you know, maybe even before it's published or now it's been published, like, you know, the emails or the people in person, like what kind of response have you gotten?
Oh, I've gotten so many great responses. So many mothers that are writing to me that, you know, I lost my son, and they're all about the same age. My son was a week shy of his 25th birthday, and all the mothers that have written to me lost their children around the same age, and due to, you know, mental illness or addiction or suicide. And so I've gotten a lot of love and support.
I'm so glad to hear that. It's a book, it's, you know, it's one of those books you put it down and it's not like you just move on with your day. I mean it sticks with you, and you know, unfortunately it's you know, it's true. So much to think about there. I mean, the book is you, like you said, you have the first book, it was a workout book, but this is a memoir. This is about you. This is about your life. And obviously it's called, I don't even know if it said the title, pardon me, it's Fighting for My Life. You talked about the, when you were approached by the agent and everything like that, I got to figure that the idea for the memoir goes back even further. I wonder about some of the seeds for the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, it goes back, you know, I mean, my story started long before my ex-husband and my son died, you know, with my dysfunction as a teenager and being first generation born in America, especially during the time that I grew up, you know, I was born in the late 60s. So, you know, that was like the height of the Vietnam War, civil rights movement, Chicano pride, you know, there was a lot that was going on. So, and growing up in an alcoholic home, I naturally became an alcoholic myself. So, yeah, so the story goes long, starts long before the tragedies.
I mean, do you remember yourself even thinking like literally like I want to write a book, or it's just kind of like there's just so much material for it?
Yeah, I've always wanted to write a book, but like I said, I didn't get the opportunity until after Christoph passed.
The book starts off with the boxer Panchito Bojado. Am I saying his name right?
Yeah.
And when you were training, and he would come in every day, or you'd see him, and he'd say something to the effect of "It's a beautiful day, and the sun is shining." And you were kind of you're kind of like, "Oh, okay, yeah, cool, right?"
I didn't really get that, and until I asked him one day, like, "Why do you always say that?" And he said, "Because boxing is such a dark world that when I see the sun out, he always felt better." And I, shortly into my career, I realized what he meant, because it is such a dark, dark world. Just the pain that you go through in boxing, not just physically, but the mental pain, right. You know, it's a difficult sport.
Oh man. You just a little few pages on, you'd written, "I could never verbalize what it meant to be a fighter until now." I was going to ask you about, like, you know, could you have written this book before? And obviously with the tragedies, you know, that came, but even just like, could you have written about being a boxer, like in, you know, you started around like what, 98, 90, and like 96, 98 around there?
I started fighting at a young age, but I didn't turn pro until 1997.
Right. Okay. So I just wonder about like perspective, you know what I mean? Now, you're still very young, but, you know, I mean, could you have written could you have written about like the boxing part of it and the dark world, like while you were in it? Or is like, I wonder what perspective over the years has given you.
You know, I don't know. Yeah, I think I could have. I'm not sure how much interest there would have been just to hear another boxer's story. Sure. You know, it's people kind of aren't really interested in that because it's a world that not many people live in, right? And that are part of and really understand it. So it would have been for a small group. And I wanted to reach the masses, you know, on a deeper level.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, the greatest quote unquote sports books are not about sports at all. Right. I mean, yours is about so much more. It's not just a boxing book or a sports book. You write.
Right. No one wants to read about boxing.
Right. Like you said, a very small group probably. Right.
Very small.
You also write, "When I step into the ring, I walk into the darkest part of my soul." And then, you know, some of the effect of "where I could unload the baggage filled with years of pain I endured throughout my childhood." How, if you're walking into the darkest part of your soul, like what was boxing for you though? Like, was it like a cleansing of that dark part?
Yeah, is the thrill, you know, the thrill of competition, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Both are significant. Both are important to experience both. And it is so dark because you are digging into like all that pain and because most of us, like, I don't know any fighters that are not dysfunctional or had, you know, some kind of a hard life. Like I said, for anyone to go into that ring and to risk your life and risk taking the life of another human, you have to be somewhat dysfunctional. Like, no functioning person says, "Yeah, I want to go get hit in the head and possibly die." And yes, I'm willing to kill another human being. No, that takes a little bit of, like I said, you had to have suffered some dysfunction because there's nothing normal about that.
Yeah. You write about, you know, winning was everything. And then losing was a motivator for you. I mean, that's a theme throughout the book, like, you know, getting it from your mom, just like, nothing's going to hold me down. I mean, the whole title, Fighting for My Life.
Well, I mean, exactly like what you said, it was, that's how I felt like after the death of my son, like, you know, and the death of Christoph, I lost it. You know, I ended up 51-50 twice, and that's an involuntary psychiatric hold in a hospital, wanting to end my own life. And I came out realizing that, no, I got to keep going. I've got to keep fighting. That's what my son would have wanted. That's what Christoph would have wanted. I had to keep going.
Yeah. Well, that comes through for sure. I mean, the ending of the book is, I don't know if beautiful is the term, but beautiful as far as like that strength. You wrote, to know my pain is to learn how I came to be. And you write about, you know, your mom growing up in Zacatecas. Is it Juchipila?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Juchipila.
And very interesting. I mean, you talk about how like it was just so open and so rural that like it was really cool, but also really lonely. Is that a good way to sum it up for your mom?
I don't know if it was lonely for my mom. You know, she had her family, but I think she just wanted a better life.
I see.
Just to live on a farm. Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Sure. But
I still have cousins and, you know, aunts and uncles that still live on the farm, and and that's fine. But she just wanted something more, something different. She wanted desperately to come to America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And my father made that possible.
It sounds like your mom made the first move, like she asked him out?
Well, she was working in a little restaurant that she owned, and he used to come in. He was in the Navy.
Okay.
And stationed in San Diego and would cross the border into Tijuana. And that's where he met my mother and brought her to the United States. And that was that.
So I know that he, like you said, he was an alcoholic. Would you say he was a functioning alcoholic?
You know, I'd have to say he was functioning because he didn't function well at home, but my dad is a nuclear engineer.
Whoa.
And worked on the biggest power plants in the world. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'd have to say he functioned pretty well. God knows what he would have been like if he wasn't an alcoholic. He would have probably been a genius. Sure. I mean, he's a very smart man. He still is to this day, but he is still in his illness, even though he's retired. You know, he's still, you could say, yeah, he's still functioning.
Wow. You write about how you're very similar to your mom, looks wise, personality wise, beautiful phrase, and the layers of emotion that came with grief. I think that was just talking about what you'd seen. Oh, that was when you're talking about your mom and her losing her own mom. You experienced a lot of racism growing up. Is that pretty safe to say?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, remember I was born in the late 60s. And so throughout the 70s, I experienced a lot of racism, even in the 80s, because I went to mostly all white schools and would usually be the only Latino in the school. So it was really difficult. People didn't know, first of all, what I was. Was I Black? Was I Asian? Was I Mexican? And so, yeah, I suffered all the racial slurs.
Well, I mean, we're, you know, I'm sure the reader like me was like, you know, I'm not a violent person, but we're rooting for you to beat the crap out of those people, right? And you talk about, I think in, I don't know if it was in Washington or Iowa multiple times, but you didn't feel good about it, right? But it was like this girl was asking for it and you gave it to her.
Well, you know, it's sad. It's sad that I learned after the first girl I beat up, I all of a sudden, like, I came to school the next day and I thought, oh my God, now I'm really going to get it. Everyone's going to come after me and hate me, which they already did. But instead, I got the opposite. I got respect. All of a sudden, it was, hi, Mia. Hi, Mia. How are you, Mia? And I learned very on that that's how I could gain respect, was by beating the shit out of another person and don't fuck with me. And that's a sad thing to learn. But like I said, I was dysfunctional, you know, and the bullied becomes the bully.
Yes.
So I became the bully.
Right. You talked about, like, when you lived in Washington, so you moved around a lot with your dad's job. Sounds like Washington was paradise for at least a little while, right?
And it was, yeah. Washington's to this day, it remains my favorite place in the world.
Oh, wow. Oh, boy. I have family from the Tacoma area. I'm not sure how close you
are. Oh, yeah. I know Tacoma. We were more on the Vancouver side by Portland, Oregon.
Right.
Yeah, but I know Tacoma.
Yeah. I wonder how that changed you, as like having to move around so much and like always being the new girl, like how that changed you.
That was rough. That was rough, but I experienced so much. I mean, my dad, you know, as dysfunctional as he was, he taught me so much, and we got to see the world literally, you know, and that was because of my dad.
Your mom, like you talked about, like you wrote about, she grew up in a place where it was like, when the kids, like, she grew up very Catholic. Is that safe to say?
Yes.
But she grew up in, like, you know, small town area where it was like, when the kids were old enough, they're working. You kind of talked about how you resisted as a kid. I mean, I think a lot of times, right, when we're the people we're the most similar to, we're often the most in contact, in conflict with, you know. But you're talking about how you were kind of expecting, you just as a kid, you wanted to get out and play and do, you know, other things, and she was kind of expecting more that you'd be helping.
A worker. My mother sent me to work in the fields when I was 10 years old.
Whoa, yeah.
And actually it was a great experience. I mean, people think like, oh my God, that's so abusive, but I actually loved it.
Yes. But, you know, you wrote about how your dad was gone a lot, unfortunately. He was abusive, and that's how you started drinking. I mean, I know it's not that simple. It's a little bit more complicated, but what was it that alcohol, I guess, did for you?
Gave me confidence. Gave me I felt good. I felt good in my own skin. But as every alcoholic, you know, that doesn't last long. That feeling is very short lived, and then it becomes a real illness, and then it becomes an addiction, and that is there's no fun in that. The fun is over. The fun is only in like the first few times, and then that quickly fades.
Right. You described it very well in the book, how, I mean, I think maybe more later in your life, a couple years later, but it was like, it was just enough. It was just to like maintain, right? Like you said, it wasn't like party and have fun. It was just like, I need it.
Oh yeah. Oh no. Those days were long gone. Like, after I relapsed, I stayed sober for 30 years. And when I relapsed, thank you. But I did relapse and, have spent the last 3 years struggling with the illness, and it became just a way to function, to get through the day, you know, because you experience the shakes, you know, the DTs, and your body just can't handle not having the alcohol. And so you drink just to maintain, just to be able to function.
Right.
Just to not get sick. Right. It's kind of like a heroin addict, you know, they shoot up just to get well, just to be okay. Not because you long past the high. There's no high anymore.
Sure. You know, so you had a fresh start in California after high school graduation. Your sister ended up moving in with you, but you went by yourself at first, right?
I went by myself with $600 in my pocket, or actually $500. And of course, you know, not enough to get an apartment. I lived out of my truck for a couple weeks, and then found a $300 apartment in Van Nuys, California. And It was an interesting time.
Shout out to
showering. I took showers at Chevron.
Oh boy.
I would go into the bathroom and
Well, shout out to Van Nuys. That's where our shared friend would live for a while too. Shout out to Van Nuys, California.
Oh yeah, Van Nuys, California. I'm a Valley girl. I went from Van Nuys to Calabasas. How's that?
Kardashian.
I worked my way up the ladder.
I wonder, you wrote about working at Club Starlight for a bit, and I wonder what that taught you about men and humanity. I mean, there's some pretty gross people, sounds like you worked with.
Yeah, I learned, wow, that's like a part of my life no one's brought up yet, except for you. oh my goodness. An embarrassing part of my life, but it did teach me a lot about LA and the way things work here. And I love LA. LA is my home, but there is like a seedier side to LA, especially downtown. And I learned that very early on, how to kind of get by in the city.
Well, no, I read that part and I didn't feel any, there was no contempt for you at all. It was all on the other side. I mean, it was the way, the people, the men that were the gross ones. That was, pretty disgusting, really, the way that they acted. You took your mom's advice. She was always about education, and you went out there and you got, I know you have your degree or degrees in psychology, right?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's in psychology, which my mother made me do. She said, you're not turning pro in anything until you get a bachelor's degree. And so I chose psychology.
Well, yeah, I mean, that comes through in the book, about the expertise you have in the field. And so a little bit after that, you met Christoph St. John, the famous actor, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I met him at an AA meeting.
Right. Right. And it sounds like he was already on the road to fame. Is that safe to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had started acting when he was 7. Okay. And when I saw him at the meeting, I already knew who he was because I used to watch his sitcom. But I pretended like I didn't know who he was, of course. I'm not going to admit that I know who, knew who he was. But yeah, so we fell madly in love and had 2 kids, got married, blah, blah, blah.
Well, yeah, you wrote that it was destiny. You've always been an independent person. You got into Taekwondo, or you've been doing it before. And Mr. V was a mentor, huh?
He really was. After my divorce, after Christoph left and I was single with 2 kids, and I would come to class and be crying, and he would say, stop your crying, get up off your ass. And he would, oh my God, he would say, stop feeling sorry for yourself. And he really pushed me. I mean, in a strong way. I mean, he was, some would say that he was a little bit mean, but it's what I needed, because I needed to to get off my ass and stop feeling sorry for myself and make something of my life.
And you sure did. I read it as pretty much you were really in Taekwondo and you were really good at it, but it was kind of like boxing seemed to be the ticket for, like, I guess you were quote unquote old for Taekwondo. Did I read that right? I mean, you're only late 20s, but it sounds like the in Taekwondo you were like quote unquote too old, even though you're only in your late 20s. Is that kind of why you changed to boxing?
Right. Yeah. Because I wanted to go to the Sydney Olympics and I realized all the girls were so young. And so I decided to turn pro. Christy Martin was on the undercards of Tyson and I wanted to be on the undercards of De La Hoya. And so, yeah, I wrote a letter to Don King and he responded miraculously. What you think you become.
I love it. You were speaking it into existence. And I mean, it wasn't all roses, obviously, but you had a pretty quick, you know, rise. And you wrote really well. Like you said, you know, not a lot of people know obviously what it's like to be a boxer at such a high level as you. And you really let us in on it. I have a friend who I used to teach with who had a like maybe 5 or 6 episode run on WWE. Not as a wrestler. He was Dr. Shelby, who was like a therapist, you know, kind of like the foil to all these like tough guys. Anyways, he talks about he's going out for his first episode, you know, live, you know, at this big old arena. And he's like, I'm cool, I got this. And the guy who works for WWE is like, are you sure you're ready? He's like, of course. Like, he literally, all he had to do was like point or something, right? He said when he went out there, it was like, you know, indescribable. He was like, you know, like couldn't even like put one foot in front of the other, right? It was just so much adrenaline and all that. So I wonder if you could describe like the high or even like the low. What it's like.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, when you take that walk, like when that knock comes at the door at the dressing room saying showtime, my legs literally turned to rubber and I didn't even know how I would get through the tunnel to the ring. I was frozen with just fear and panic and sweating and shaking. And but once that bell rings, it's all over. It's really? All over. The nerves okay. are gone. The nerves are gone. Once that first punch comes in, it's over. It's on. And the adrenaline kicks in and it's probably the best high in the world.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Well, thank you for saying that in the book, you know, writing about it in the book and describing here. It's like a nice peek into some, you know, a lot of us will never know about. You had an incredible mentor in with Art, who, you know, you said called you like his little girl. And you know, absolutely shattering to read about when he passed away. And obviously I know that was so crushing for you. How has he put his footprint on you, so to speak, even to this day?
Well, he was the only one that believed in me, because back in the 90s, in the early mid 90s, women weren't even allowed in a lot of the boxing gyms. It was men only. And so we had to train in a park. And he was the only one that believed in me, you know. And when I told him my dreams, like, I want to sign with Don King, I want to sign with Bob Arum, I want to open for Oscar De La Hoya, I want to be a world champion, he would just like laugh and pat me on the back and he'd say, all in good time, little Mia. And, you know, he believed in me.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful thing to have somebody like that. You got pretty quickly into what, you know, what you write about is like the shadiness of boxing and, you know, with the big promoters, and you worked, you know, under Bob Arum, and you figured out like, oh man, sometimes they kind of like set like a tomato can, right? Like they kind of like set up certain fights for you. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, it's common in boxing. When you have someone that you want to make a champion, you slowly build them up and you bring in what they call tomato cans, which are girls that, or men that don't know how to fight, that are just set up to lose. Like, hey, you want a payday, go in the ring and get your ass kicked. But it's not that they don't try. I mean, they come in there to tear your head off. Because if they win, oh my God, then the glory's on them, and then they get to shine. So they do try to tear your head off, but even if it's a close fight, the scorecards will go towards the favor, you know, the one that is being built to be the champion.
Sure.
But yeah, they try to set you up with people who are really novices in the sport. And so, yeah, it's a shady game. It's boxing, like I said, is a very dark world.
Oh boy. you write about the like the paradox of like, I mean, obviously you're in front of thousands, hundreds of, you know, tens of thousands, hundred thousands of people watching at home, but you're also like, there's a lot of solitude. Like, how would you describe the solitude of boxing?
Well, you're alone. Like, you have like thousands of people like watching you, right? And all eyes are on you, and you just feel alone. Like, no one can understand your pain, yeah, your fear at the moment, except the other person standing across the ring from you, your opponent.
Sure.
Is the only other person that feels what you're feeling and can understand. And so you kind of have this camaraderie with your opponent, yet you're trying to tear her head off.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you love that person.
Hmm. Yeah, that was really interesting to read about, like that camaraderie and that love with someone who you're trying to beat the crap out of. But it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about all eyes on you, and so like your social life started to get like scrutinized, and I mean, I guess this is probably before TMZ, but like, and you, like you did Playboy. Was Playboy like a positive overall, or not so much?
Yeah, it was so positive because, cool. You know, Hugh Hefner, you know, was known for just loving blondes and blue-eyed blondes, and I was originally not the cover. There was a blonde blue-eyed girl that was supposed to be the cover, and I went to Hef and I said, hey, like, us Latinas are beautiful and we deserve to shine just like the rest of them. And anyway, I got a call like 2 weeks later that I was to come in to shoot the cover.
All right.
That Hef had changed his mind, and so I became the cover of November 1999.
November 1999. Did you call him Hef?
Hef? Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Was Mr. Hefner. Mr. Okay. Hefner.
Okay. Was he smoking a pipe and wearing like a robe or something? Like you always see him?
Always. Always.
That's funny.
Always.
Okay, you got to fight on the undercard of De La Hoya Chavez.
Yes.
What the?
That historical fight.
Oh my gosh. Can you explain that a little bit? I'm sure words won't even put it into, you know, but wow.
Well, that was my first fight for Oscar De La Hoya. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was, oh my God, it was unreal. It was surreal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because here it was De La Hoya, this new champion, and he was going to fight, you know, a legend,
mm-hmm,
you know, mm-hmm, and so all the Mexicans were in the arena that night, and it was crazy. It was really like memorable.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying, right? But I mean, De La Hoya was like, you know, good looking dude. Like he said, you know, he's American, he's Pocho. And like Chavez was like the tough, tough, tough veteran, right? Was it like, I mean, was it like 90% Chavez like fans, or was it fairly even? Or?
Yeah, there were. Yeah, I'd say it was mostly fans for Chavez because people didn't, a lot of Mexicans didn't recognize Oscar as Mexican.
Mm.
He's Chicano.
Okay.
So, you know, the Mexicans don't really see Chicanos as Mexican, and we're not, you know, we're American.
Hmm.
I mean, that's a fact. Like, we are Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved it because that's where I was proud to be a Chicana, and I was proud that where my family came from, but mm-hmm, also the country that I was born in.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you had me Googling the Selena version. What was the song you came out to? Was it La Bamba by Selena?
Bitty Bitty Bamba. Oh. That one. And oh, I came out to many of them. Bitty Bitty Bam Bam.
Yeah. There was one of the songs, I forget which one in the book, but I was like, it had me Googling. I was like, oh, cool. I didn't know she did that version. Okay, that's cool. So,
yeah.
So I guess right around a little bit after that, you kind of became a free agent. And you went to was it Fernando Vargas's trainer in Oxnard, California?
Yeah. And I started training at their camp.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was a great relationship. I still have a great relationship with them. Cool. But they really changed my fighting. I was a fighter, and they turned me into a boxer.
Uh-huh. So then, you know, going from a fighter to boxer, I mean, is that, how do you regulate, like, maybe like thinking more in the, like, how do you think more without losing the pop? Do you know what I mean?
Got composure, meditation. You have to learn how to control your breathing, how to control your thoughts, and your adrenaline, you know. And they did that very well for me, and I became a counter puncher when I used to fight very offensively, and then I learned defense, and that's the key is defense. You could be a great offensive fighter, but if you don't have defense, you're screwed. And that's what they taught me.
Was your, like, if you had to say, like, a number one goal at that time, was it like, was it getting ready for Christy Martin?
Oh, that was always the goal from day one, was to fight Christy Martin, my
And
nemesis.
right. Sorry, tell me the year again of the first fight against her. Was it 2001, 2002?
Oh my gosh. I don't even remember. I don't know.
You've had so many great ones.
I know I beat her in the rematch in 2012.
Yeah, yes. I like that little
Revenge.
yes, revenge. I'm looking it up right now, Christy Martin. But the really about the first fight, but the really cool thing about the book is that you do like a little like flashback from like the 2012 fight, or flash forward where you know you do beat her, but there was like a compassion for her, right? Like she kind of she you knew
Yeah,
you knew you had her, yeah.
I was pummeling her, and all of a sudden she just threw her hands down and stopped fighting. And I kept punching her, and I kept looking at the ref like, "Are you going to stop the fight?" And he was looking at me, and he was confused, and everybody was confused. And I thought to myself at that moment, I have two choices. I can keep pummeling her and risk her life, or I could stop and risk losing the fight. And at that moment, I knew in a heartbeat what I wanted to do. And I just stopped and I hugged her and I said, "Christy, this isn't worth it." And you know, luckily the judges, you know, gave me the fight, but I took a big risk.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you, like, if you guys actually, if you said anything back and forth, or if it was just like an understanding, but you actually did have a little dialogue, huh?
I hugged her and I said, "Christy, this isn't worth it."
So it was at the Silver Dome in 2002.
Oh, okay.
Does that sound right?
Detroit, Michigan.
Detroit
That's
City,
right.
yeah.
Motor City.
So obviously all good things are all careers. I mean, you had a great career, you know, comes to an end, and you talked about, you wrote about how, you know, there's a depression. I'm thinking about that recently with, like, you know, like a Tom Brady and all these who are at the top of their career, like where all of a sudden it's like they're done. What was it like when you stopped? Was it like overnight you realized, like, whoa, I'm not a fighter anymore, or was it more a gradual thing?
Oh, it was rough. It is rough. Retirement is rough, rough. I actually bought a house in Palm Springs and I meet a lot of other retirees there. And they look at me and they're like, "You're retired, but you're so young." But it's rough. I mean, for the first week, you love it and you're like, "Yay, I can do what I want. I don't have to go train anymore." And then after about a week, you're like, "Okay, now what do I do? What's left?" And you think of all these different hobbies you could do, and you know, but that wears off, and then you're just left with like, you know, no longer do you have the adoration of the crowd, the roar of the crowd and cheering your name. All of a sudden, like, no one gives a shit anymore. Like, who are you?
Oh boy. Well, you know, you use your psychology skills, and you drummed up so much support for better mental health. You know, a lot of that came with, you know, you describe your son so beautifully as a sensitive soul, Julian. You know, he was
He
literally.
was a true just a beautiful, beautiful boy, and was a brilliant artist. Right. He had his art at originally at the Laguna Gallery of Contemporary Art, and he didn't even want to sign a contract. He was like, I just want to give my art for free. It should be free to the world, free to people. Yes. Art shouldn't be. And I was like, I was managing him. So I was like, oh, hell no. Like, we're going to charge for this shit. Like, there's no way, you know. Yeah. But he was definitely like, he just wanted to give it all away. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just the kind of kid he was.
Yeah, I mean, just the little that I got to know him through the book, just like I said, beautiful, sensitive soul, artistic. I think we all know people like him, but he was also so unique to you and to your family. You know, your daughter, you describe your daughter as such a hero to you as well, such a, you know, a kind and giving person. And you got into the mental health in the schools and such because, you know, unfortunately Julian was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And how does that manifest itself? Like, I mean, is that the voices that you write about? Is that mainly what it is?
Yeah. He was having delusions and hearing voices, and it's a very frightening thing. Mm-hmm. And if you would have told me before my son was born that I would have a child with schizophrenia, I would have just died. Like, that was my worst nightmare, because I knew through my education that there was no cure. Mm-hmm. There was no cure, and that they don't have longevity. A lot of them do end up passing away at a young age. Mm-hmm. And so when we got the diagnosis, I was scared out of my mind.
Sure.
Like, what would become of my son?
Well, I mean, you do write about some of the beautiful experiences with him, the art show, like you talk about the, I mean, I'm so glad you included pictures. There's probably like, what, 10, 15, 20 pages of pictures at the end, and, you know, great smile. It's great to, you know, like, oh, I feel like I know him, just through the book. And I know that his, so when he later, did pass away, you know, I know that obviously he has such a legacy, right?
He did. And his art lives on, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, I did, the Laguna Gallery of Contemporary Art kept some of his art after he had passed, and I went and took everything out because but I plan on putting them back and doing another gallery with his art, but I just wasn't quite ready yet. I wanted all of his pieces in my home with me because they were sacred to me, you know. Mm-hmm. and I wanted to hang on to them. Mm-hmm. But I will be doing, in fact, I was planning something for spring to do with his art.
Nice.
And so I'm ready to let the world see his art once again.
Oh, beautiful. So how is stone art connected to that, to his legacy? Is that about that, getting other people art, access to art? How does that work?
That was a program that we started in Palm Springs that was for the mentally ill that needed an outlet.
Right.
And it was a great program, you know, while it lasted. Funding ran out, but we'll be starting new programs.
I'll make sure to put the links in the episode, you know, to Stone Art and to the foundations. You know, unfortunately, you're really knowledgeable about mental health facilities because, you know, because of the, I don't know, malfeasance of the facility for Julian. Did, you know, I can't imagine how painful that was to go through all of that, including with the facility and all the, you know, going through the courts and all of that. Have you been able to talk to people who you feel like you have helped by making, you know, mental health in schools more visible, by, you know, really fighting the system, the corrupt system, et cetera? Have you been able to?
Oh, yeah. I'm in touch on a regular basis with the CEO of the Department of Mental Health. Dr. John Sharon, and we talk on a regular basis about making changes to the system.
Okay.
And one of the things is making plastic bags, I don't want to say illegal, but banning them from, sure, from high risk units.
Sure.
And other things as well. I worked with Congresswoman Napolitano on the Mental Health in Schools Act and got that passed. And so, yeah, I've been very active politically as well.
Well, I mean, nobody in the world would ever, you know, blame you for, you know, having your grief and your pain be private, because it's, you know, it's unthinkable what you've had to go through. But the fact that you've been able to use your celebrity, and I know you worked with, I was going to say Ron Artest, but Meta World
Peace. Yeah, right? Meta World Peace. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I always remember his like interview after one of those games where he, you know, shouted out his therapist, and it's been great the work he's been able to do, because he's, you know, he's so well known as well.
Yeah. Yeah, he was great to work with.
You write about Christoph as, you know, while the marriage might not have worked, he was a very, you know, a doting father. And so it was obviously very, very sad to read about him and he, you know, the grief that he felt after Julian passed away, and, you know, how he, you know, felt like he wanted to be with his son again, type of thing, and had trouble forgiving himself. How was his passing, I guess, affected the way that you look also again at mental health, and, you know, I guess especially for men, right? I guess maybe for asking for more help.
Yeah. I think again, it was the failure of our mental health system. You know, Christoph, yeah, we had in a psychiatric hospital before he passed, and they were not supposed to let him go, and they did, even though he was still suicidal.
Okay.
And yeah, they let him go, and we couldn't find him for 3 days, and till he called me that morning, and that was the morning he passed. But yeah, again, it's the failure of our mental health system.
Right. Well, I mean, you've done some incredible work, like I said, to use your platform to get information out there. And, you know, unthinkable things that have happened in your life. And you write about, you know, even with the relapse, you know, good for you, great for you, 3 years going strong. That's awesome. Something that I know you're proud of.
Thank you so much. Oh, thank you.
And, you know, and so the book ends with like, I'm fighting, right? The continuance, like your resolve, you know, that every day is a new fight, you know, in multiple ways, but it's like, let's go. Yeah. I wanted to go like, you know, run a couple laps or a couple miles after reading that end, like, you know, the resolve, right? Put on some Rocky montage music and let's go. But yeah, I mean, there are for sure heroes in the book, and you know, the way that you have been so strong, you describe your boyfriend Larry as your rock, your daughter Paris and all her incredible help and love. So, you know,
I make a grateful list every morning, and I always say God, as I understand God, which is the almighty consciousness. Mm-hmm. I say, thank you so much for letting me keep my daughter, for my boyfriend, for my dog that I inherited after Christoph passed, which was Christoph's dog. It's now my dog. Okay. And for giving me a voice, for giving me my boxing career to give me a platform to talk about mental health. Because so many mothers that go through what I go through don't have a voice, you know, they can't get media attention. And so I'm able to do that and speak for them and for all of our sons and daughters that we've lost in the system.
Right. And I know you're not stopping now. I wonder what you're working on, you know, whether there's another book in the works, but more so like with, you know, with mental health and your foundation, I wonder what's coming.
Yeah. Out. Thanks. Thanks for asking. So starting on January 18th, I start working directly with the homeless in an outreach program. Beautiful. Where we try and get the mentally ill that are homeless, psychiatric help and housing.
That's incredible. Are you working with like the city or like a certain?
Yeah. So what we will get, it's actually the organization is called Step Up.
Okay.
And we get the, we'll get the referrals from the sheriffs, of the homeless that they know, like where they're at, what, who they are. And we go try and find them and get them the help and services that they need.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, you're pretty easy to find online. You're on both Twitter and are you on Instagram as well?
I'm on Instagram at Mia St. John Boxer.
Okay.
And Twitter at Mia St. John Boxer.
Okay. And the book is called Fighting for My Life. It was through Simon & Schuster. Is that right?
They own Post Hill Press.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And written with Elaine Aradias. Shout out to her.
Yes.
Right.
Shout out to her.
Yeah. Do you have any preference to where people buy the book?
You go to Amazon. Okay. You can go to the bookstore. Yeah, wherever. And right. It's also online available on audio as well.
Oh, nice. Do you do the audio?
I did the audio.
Oh, cool.
But they had to really talk me into it because I didn't want to do it. I said, no, it's too emotional. I can't do it.
And I bet.
Finally, I said, okay. They talked me into it.
Wow. Was that, like you said, being that so emotional, is that something that you knock out in a couple of days or is that like month?
Yeah, no, it took a week.
Okay.
Took a week.
Okay. Well, you know, again, my words are not going to do any justice. They're going to sound, you know, trite or whatever, but I just really want to thank you so much for the book. It's, I mean, you know, so many of us have had some sort of grief and yours is towering, but for you to use it to help others, for you to write this book, for you to be so open and honest is just an incredible gift. So thanks for your time today. And thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great to have you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to episode 101 with Mia St. John. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the Chills at Will podcast by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music, although we don't want to give too much money to Jeff Bezos. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will podcast or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will P-O-1. You can watch other episodes on YouTube. Watch and subscribe to the Chills at Will podcast channel. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation. And I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version. And the other song played on this episode was Hoops Instrumental by Matt Whitehour. And both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for the next episode, episode 102, with Tija Jin, who is an interdisciplinary artist from North London. A London Writers Award winner, her work has been published by Extra Teeth and Skin Deep and commissioned by places like Battersea Arts Centre and St. Paul's Cathedral. She now creates digital art as part of Design Yourself, a collective based at the Barbican Centre, exploring what it means to be human when technology is changing everything. A producer and DJ, she's releasing an EP, Keeping the House, to accompany her debut novel of the same name. For now, thanks again for listening. I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Mia St. John, whose work, like Fighting for My Life, gives you chills at will.